I mean, if I can just run you through this kind of oversimplified model, if you had a little television receiver channel right here next to your eyes, what you're finding, what we're talking about, is planes of consciousness or channels on a television set. And most of us, most of the time in this culture, act as if we have a one or two channel set. We don't have cable. And today we're talking about cable. We're talking about acknowledging all these other channels that are floating around in the room, but we're not picking them up because we don't know how to tune our receiver. That's basically what this is about. So on the first channel, when you look at another human being, you see old, young, dark, light, fat, thin, etc. You see physical body. And if you're obsessed with your physical body, that's what you see when you look in the world, other people's physical bodies. That's the channel you're on. If you flip one channel, then you're in the psychosocial realm. You see power and you see happiness and sadness and neurosis, and it's the therapy channel. It's the social role channel. It's where there are mothers and truck drivers and all lawyers and all the different roles and identities, all the social stuff. That's all a channel, and that's as the world turns, and it's a never-ending source of fascination. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. Most people are happy with channel two. That's right. And channel one and two, about 98% of the people you've ever known are busy with those two channels all the time. But now we're talking about something else. We're talking about shifting. Now you shift one more channel, and there's a little in-between one, which is called, it's like the astral plane. It's where you're dealing with archetypes, the Jungian archetypes. You're dealing with what's called astral or mythic roles and mythic identities. It's that sort of place where you see people in their mythos rather than in their personality structures. You look at me and you say, he's an Aries. I just knew it. You know, it's a Sagittarius and Leos, and you see there's 12 of us in various permutations. If you flip to the next channel, you go behind all those individual differences and you just see another soul just like you that has all that packaging that's different than you, but is just another being just like you. That's when you say, are you in there? I'm in here. How'd you get in that one? And you see all of the stuff of the personality and the astral and the mythic and the body and all of it as like packaging. And you see the spiritual individual entity. And just for fun, if you turn the channel once more, what it is you're looking, it's looking at itself, looking at itself. There's only one of it. It's awareness, aware of itself. And just to keep the Buddhists happy, you turn it once more and it all disappears, which is basically the one in itself. It's basically the one in itself rather than looking at itself. First of all, most of our images of love in our society have to do with romantic love. They are poetic love. They are interpersonal love. I love you, you love me, we love each other. We all give lip service to, but hardly ever really acknowledge that there is another kind of love that is not interpersonal. We call it conscious love, or Christ's love, or God's love. And the image I have is that when you grow up in a society of conditional love, which most of us have grown up in because of the way in which we are socialized, we end up very needful for love. And that's why a lot of the literature is about love and affection. It's as if there's something in us that's very hungry. We're on a deprivation diet. And so when we meet somebody who has the key to unlock something in us, we experience that we are in love, and we say, I am in love with you. What we're really saying, another way of saying it in a kind of an instinct literature, is you are the key stimulus that is releasing the mechanism in me that allows me to be in love. You're my connection. And as my connection, I want to possess you because I'm hungry to be in this state in my being. I have come into the place of love in my being. And everything is beautiful suddenly. But it only happens when you're around. So where will you be Thursday? And where will you be Friday? And where will you be for the rest of my life? See? And the tendency is to want to possess the beloved, which, as you and I both know, is one of the quickest ways to destroy the experience. And that love has in it fear because somebody's going to die or go away or find another lover or something. That's interpersonal romantic love. And that's why there's so much poetry about it, because it has the fear and the joy and all of the stuff in it. But now take that image that the key stimulus is something that opens you to the place in yourself where you are love. And through the spiritual practices and through understanding the metaphysics and through opening yourself, you find yourself starting, whether you call it awareness, where you draw your awareness back from thought, or however you get in there through meditation, through devotion, through study, whatever your practices are, you find yourself starting to rest in the place of presence in your being, which has the quality of that openness, that boundarylessness, that heart, intuitive heart space, where you experience that you are in love. But now you are no longer dependent on an external thing to awaken you to it. You're beginning to rest in it. You are beginning to be love. Now, the social problems that raises are very interesting, because what happens is now everyone you look at, you are in love with. And you don't quite know what to do, because if you've been working on an old deprivation model, you want to collect them all. So you get one and you say, let's nest. And you go back and you get twigs and drapes and, you know, make a nest. And then after some time you say, I'm going to the supermarket to get some tofu and beer. And at the checkout counter, you look at the person at the checkout counter and it happens again. I mean, because now when the eyes, you see, are the windows to the soul, and the soul rests in love. The soul is a being within the place of love. So you look and there's your beloved. Now what are you going to do? You got one at home. So you say, have you considered a ménage à trois? But what are you going to do then? Are you going to not walk down the street and look at anybody? Because it's going to keep happening. And you realize that you're going to have to give up your deprivation model, because there's an abundance of love. You're going to have to stop collecting it. And you're just going to start to go so that you pass your beloved on the street and you don't even wink. So you go through stages of, at first you can't believe it. See? So you go down the street and you meet one and you say, let's have coffee together. Or give me your telephone number, you know, in case I run out of the others later. I want to know that this one is, because it's so beautiful. And then after a while, you just keep letting go and letting go and letting go until you realize that isn't the way. You're just living in this presence of love. Because the thing that has closed you down is the fear of the other person's pain and suffering. And once you have that spiritual perspective that allows you to keep your heart open in the hell and the pain and the grief and the stuff, then you can start to be in love with another human being without feeling the possessive quality about it. And so with Mary, I'm sitting with Mary and I am falling into love with her. And that is both levels. The personal level, I'm attached to her, I don't want her to die. I've gotten to love her so much, I don't want her to die. And the other part, she and I are just floating in the ocean of love. And I realize, and what she is experiencing is such an intimate human contact, as I am. We are both dying together. And we go right up to the moment of death. And at that point, what happened to me in that case was I then found myself separating myself from her because I wasn't yet capable of staying in love through death. And that's my work on myself. I could stay in love through dying, but not through death yet. And yet, love transcends death. But to be that wisdom is different than knowing that wisdom. And I am dying into that wisdom. Is this too weird for you, or are you still here with me? Because I work a lot with people that are grieving, and my way of supporting grieving is to say, grieve, my God, grieve. Don't try to stop grieving. Don't be strong. Grieve some more. Go grieve some more. Just allow the human pain. Don't hide it. Just let it keep going through it. And then at some point, you will quiet down naturally. It might take a couple of years. Who knows? At some point, you will quiet down. You will be quiet enough to realize that the love, when you and another person enter into the space of love together for even a moment, that relationship has transcended relationship. You have entered into a unitive moment together, and that transcends death. And at that moment, when you quiet down enough and you're sitting with your beloved, you suddenly realize that where did they go? As Ramana Maharshi said, where could I go? I'm still here. Just the form that left. You were busy missing the form. You weren't missing the essence, because the essence is here. And when you recognize that, you feel as a human being enriched by everybody you have loved, instead of deprived by the loss of their form. You realize that they're living through you, and that everybody you've ever loved is part of the fabric of your being now, in the way in which you go forward. And that's where grief gets transformed into a living love space, a spiritual transcendence of the pain. There was a nurse in a seminar that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and I were doing together. She was about in her, I think, late 20s, and she had three children, and she had advanced cancer. And she had been through many, many operations. And it was a very poignant story with three young children. And she said to the audience, what would you feel if you came to visit me in the hospital? And different people raised their hands, and Elizabeth wrote on the board, and some of them said anger, and some of them said anger at God, some of them said pain, some of them said sadness at your plight, some of them said confusion, a whole list of things. And she then said, you see the predicament. She said, all of you were so busy being with 28-year-old nurse with three children with cancer, nobody was with me. You see the issue, I mean, when working with an AIDS patient or cancer patient, really, the symbolic power of dying is so powerful that it's extremely hard to get through it to be with the person behind it. Like, I have a friend, Kelly, who was a quadriplegic. Kelly was a quadriplegic. He was hit on the side of the head when he was about 9 years old, and it was misdiagnosed. So you can hold his hand over an alphabet board, and he can spell out words, and that's the way he communicates. And he's like this, and he's fully awake and fully brilliant, and he's 33 years old. Kelly is a delight, absolutely a delight. I had Kelly introduce me once when I was speaking before a group of doctors and holistic health healers, and about 500 people in the audience, and Kelly was wheeled onto the stage, and of course, they were all aghast, you know, like, Kelly spells out, R.D., Ram Dass, R.D. says, we are not our bodies, amen. But when I met Kelly, the immensity of his predicament so caught my consciousness that it took me almost 6 months of visiting with him before I could get behind the symbolic power of his identity, his social identity, and his physical identity, to meet him, to say, are you in there? And now Kelly and I have been together for 8 years, and, you know, I mean, he's just another being, just like me. He's just got his karmic trip, and I got mine. I've just been through a very profound experience with Kelly. About 2 months ago, Kelly said to me, I've decided I've had enough, and I'd like to commit suicide. I said, well, you have every right to do that. He said, what do you think about it? I said, well, a human birth is an opportunity to do incredible spiritual work. And you've been doing incredible work, and there's a lot more you could do because you're still a hung-up, greedy little bastard. But you could do some great work. Kelly and I have a good relationship, as you can see. I said, but, you know, I don't know how much... The game is you take what you can take, and when you have had enough taking, you stop. There's no blame, you know. Nobody's going to come and say, you committed suicide, your turn. Not from where I'm sitting. I said, and I'll miss you terribly. I wish you wouldn't, because I really love having you around, but you have a right to do it. The problem is, how are you going to do it? So he can't take anything. He can't move his hand. He can't take pills. He can't cut his throat. What's he going to do? So we talked about it, and I said, well, I think the only way you can do it is not eat. Because he can just, most of the stuff goes in, he chokes as he's being fed, but he can swallow. So that day, he decided to stop eating. And he called his mother and his father and his step-parents and all gathered, and the doctor and everybody. And I had gone and left for somewhere else, and he kept saying, Ram Dass has given me the courage. I thought, oh, God, oh, yeah. And I've decided to stop living. And so he fasted for 49 days. And I spoke to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, now, this young man could do a great deal with his life. And, you know, he was being doctory, because he had to protect his insurance. And I said, well, doctor, tell me, if you were in Kelly's predicament for 20 years, he said, I don't know. I said, well, that's the predicament. I don't either. And when we don't know, we've got to give Kelly the support to do what he wants to do, because how are we to tell him what to do? So then, around the 48th day, I came to see Kelly. He had lost 30 pounds. He was too weak almost to push the button. I mean, it took a long time to get the thing out. And he said, what do you think happens at the moment of death? So I told him what I thought would happen. He said, it's still all right with you if I die? I said, it's up to you. I miss you, and I think you could do more work, but it's okay with me. And that evening, he ate. But in those 48 days, he took me through so much. He took his parents through so much. He took everybody. Now, most of the people around him are really pissed off at him. They're really angry at him. How could you do this to us? And he said to me, are you angry with me? I said, angry? What a gift you gave me. You took me so close to the issue. You kept me awake with it all the way through. When you get to the place where your awareness is really clear, let me just tell you a story. Just give you a couple of stories to give you feelings. In an olden time, an army is going through villages and it's killing many people, and it's a Buddhist country, and it's disemboweling the monks, and it's getting rid of Buddhism, which happened a lot in times of Genghis Khan and stuff like that. And there was one particularly harsh captain, and he had a bad reputation of being very cruel. And he came into this town, and he said to his adjutant, what's happening in the town? The adjutant said, all the people are bowing down to you. They're all afraid of you. And in the monastery, all the monks have fled to the mountains, except for one monk. And the captain was furious that there was a monk who was still there. And he got up, and he walked to the monastery, and he pushed open the gates. And there in the middle of the courtyard was the monk, just standing there. And the captain walked up to him, and he said, don't you know who I am? I could take my sword and run it through your belly without blinking an eye. And don't you know who I am? Said the monk. I could have your sword run through my belly without blinking an eye. Apocryphally, the captain bowed and left. And when you start to get into the spiritual literature, you start to see a lightness about death. A Zen monk is dying, and Zen monk's masters are supposed to leave a verse. And he hadn't written his verse, and his students were very concerned he died before he wrote his verse. So they kept saying, what about your verse? What about your verse? So he picked up his brush and he calligraphied, birth is thus, death is thus, verse or no verse, what's the fuss? And he died. I want to read you just two things. And I went way out on a limb here, and I had to do this, and I'll explain why. This is one of the hardest stories you'll have to hear. An 11-year-old girl and her girlfriend went to the Jewish Community Center in the Northwest to play tennis, and they were both raped and murdered. And I was called that night by somebody who said, the parents are people who have read your books and listened to your tapes, and perhaps there's something you could say to them at this moment. And I realized I couldn't do it tomorrow. It had to be done right now. And so I sat down. And the enormity of that pain was so great, it catapulted me out of the ego part of me that felt insecure in writing. And so I wrote this letter, which I'd like to share with you. Dear Steve and Anita, Rachel, the daughter, Rachel finished her work on Earth and left the stage in a manner that leaves those of us left behind with a cry of agony in our hearts as the fragile thread of our faith is dealt with so violently. Is anyone strong enough to stay conscious through such teachings as you are receiving? Very few. And even they would have only the briefest whisper of equity equanimity and peace amidst the screaming trumpets of their rage, grief, horror, and desolation. I can't assuage your pain with any words, nor should I. For your pain is part of Rachel's legacy to you. Not that she or I would inflict such pain by choice, but there it is. And it must burn its purifying way to completion. For something in you dies when you bear the unbearable. And it is only in that dark night of the soul that you are prepared to see as God sees and to love as God loves. Now is the time to let your grief find expression, no false strength. Now is the time to sit quietly and speak to Rachel and thank her for being with you these few years and encourage her to go on with her work, knowing that you will grow in compassion and wisdom from this experience. In my heart, I know that you and she will meet again and again and recognize the many ways in which you have known each other. And when you meet, you will, in a flash, know what now it is not given to you to know, why this had to be the way it was. Our rational minds can never understand what has happened. But our hearts, if we can keep them open to God, will find their own intuitive way. Rachel came through you to do her work on earth, which included her manner of death. Now her soul is free, and the love that you can share with her is invulnerable to the winds of changing time. In love, Ramdas. Let me just share with you one more story. When I came back from India in 1968, I was living in New Hampshire on my father's farm. And a young fellow came to see me. He was about 18 or 19. He was living in the Lower East Side of New York. He was from Russian parents. And he was from quite wealthy parents, actually. But he was living as a kind of a hippie in New York with his girlfriend. And he came to see me and he said, I'd like to study yoga with you. Hatha yoga and so on. I was teaching all those things at the time. And we sat together and he was a very unusual fellow. And at one point, we were looking in one another's eyes, and this blue light flashed between our third eyes. And it was so powerful, we both fell over backwards at the same moment. And I had no idea what that was. So he began to study yoga, and he would come to see me. His parents had a place nearby in an island, and he would go there, and he came to see me. And he started to improve. He was doing hatha yoga. Pretty soon, he was doing it. By the end of the summer, I said, look, you now need a real teacher. I mean, I'm great, but I'm kind of a schlock, you know, teacher, and you need a real one. And so I'd suggest you see so-and-so or so-and-so. He said, well, I think I have enough of the basics. I'm going to go into a cave on my parents' place down in Arizona, and I'm just going to do yoga all winter. If I can just fly to wherever you are once a month and see you, fine. So every month he would fly to see me, and he was starting to look like a yogi. He was fasting, and he was getting that kind of look about him. And then he didn't come in February, and he didn't come in March. And in April, and I didn't think much about it, in April I got a letter from his mother saying, my son has entered Mahasamadhi, which in India means it's when you die and you enter the enlightened state. That's very strange for a Russian woman to say to me. And I realized she was saying her son had died. She said, I'm coming to see you because I have to show you his diary. So she came to see me, and she was somewhat of a hysterical woman, and she showed me this diary, and it said, scribbled in big scrawl on the pages, was, Mother, I have finished my work. I am with Christ, and I with Maharaji, which is my guru, who he met through me. Tell Ram Dass it's all right. I will be watching over you. You need have no fear. Vaya con Dios. Go with God. Love. Signed it. She says, see, he finished his work. To be honest with you, what happened to me when I looked at that book was I saw this big scrawling writing, and I thought, where have I seen that before? And then I remembered that in all the times I've taken LSD, there are moments when you are way, way, way out there, and you suddenly see the grand design of the entire universe, and you want to remember it. So I would stagger across the room to get a pen and something to write on. And I'd write this laboriously, this wise thing, which the next day would turn out to be like the word is. Which undoubtedly was the secret of the universe, except I no longer understood it. So it looked to me like it was acid writing. And I thought, uh-oh, he took acid, and he probably, because they found him in his cave with blood on the walls from his nose, he probably took acid and did pranayama or something and burst his heart and died. She said, he did finish his work and he's enlightened, isn't he? I said, well, I don't know. But I said, I know somebody who would know, my guru in India, because he knows everything. I'll ask him. I'm going in the fall. I'll ask him, send me a picture of your son. So she sent me his high school graduation picture, which I put in my valise for going to India. 6 months later, I'm in India. I've forgotten about the picture. It's in my stuff. One day, we're sitting with my guru, my spiritual teacher, and he's looking through everybody's bags and taking out their pictures and looking at them and kidding about them. And I remember this picture. So I go back to my room and I get the picture and I bring it out. I don't say a word about it. I haven't talked to anybody about it. And I place it on his thing he's sitting on in front of him, and he's talking, and finally he looks down, he looks at this high school graduation picture, and he says to me, he's dead. I said, yep. He said, he died from your medicine, meaning the LSD. I've got to tell you, I've forgotten one part of the story. 2 weeks after the mother came, his friend came, his brother actually came, and he said, I've got to tell you this. He said, I went to visit with a friend of mine. I went to visit my brother out in the cave. And I brought some acid, and we all took acid together, and we went swimming. And while we were swimming, he came over to hug me, and I went into a homophobic reaction, and I pushed him away. And he got upset, and he told us to leave, and that was the last time I saw him alive. So now you see what I had in my mind. He took acid, paranoid, went back, tried to do yoga, killed himself. That's not enlightenment. Now Maharaji, my guru, is sitting there. He says, he died from your medicine. I said, see, I knew it. And Maharaji looked at me and said, nay. He heard the tone of my voice. And then Maharaji said, he is one with Christ and with me. He finished his work. He is watching over his mother. She need not fear. And he quoted word from this boy's diary. Exactly, word for word. And he said he told her to go with God. He said he finished his work. And when he said that to me, all of my models about how you're supposed to die were completely undercut. And I realized that when somebody was ready, the hook came out from the side of the stage and they left. And our models of you're supposed to go out dancing were just our models. That it was a much deeper story than that. And my guru said, nobody dies a moment before their time, and nobody remains a moment after it. And in Tibet, where they have cultivated so much awareness free of identity with that which changes, there are lamas who are so conscious that there was one that sent out cards to everybody saying, I will be dying next Thursday at 2:00. Won't you come by for tea? People came, they had tea, he turned around 3 times, sat down, went into samadhi, and left his body. Now, I just want to play with the edge of the mystery with you. The mystery of Anita's death, the mystery of Mary's death, the mystery of the mystery, the mystery, the mystery. There's one more little funny story. Mother and Dad exchanged one red rose on every anniversary as a token of their love. My mother died in 1966. big funeral at the temple. Everybody's there to share the grief. The casket is covered with a blanket of roses, red roses. As the casket is wheeled down the aisle and goes by the first pew, in which my father, who's a very practical lawyer, my brother, who's a very practical lawyer, his wife, who's a very practical wife, I have another brother who's crazy and thinks he's the Messiah, and his wife, who's a very practical person, and me, who's completely meshuggah. So as the casket goes by, one rose falls off the blanket at my father's feet. Now, who can resist? That's it. We all see the rose. As we are leaving, my father reaches down and picks up the rose, and we go out and get into the Cadillac limousine for the ride to the airport. My brother, the Messiah, says, I guess Mother sent you a message. Because nobody else could say that. They were all too practical. But everybody agreed, because they were all in that state, you know. I mean, they'd never agree on other conditions, but they all agreed. The next thought in the car was, how will we save the rose? Okay. This was in 66, so preserving methods were... So it involved suddenly telephone calls and this's and that's and flying it in ice to somewhere. And it was put in a glass container, you know, with water in it, sealed in, and it was on the mantelpiece. But the method hadn't worked quite well, and slowly it turned this kind of... The water turned this kind of brackish, brownish quality. And after a few years, my father was ready to remarry. And carrying this brackish thing. So it ended up in the back of the garage where I found it and put it on my holy table as a reminder of the transitory nature of phenomena. In Tibet, when they give me the instructions, they say, at the end, they say, as the earth element leaves, your body will feel heavy. As the water element leaves, you will feel dryness. As the fire element leaves, you may feel cold. As the air element leaves, your out-breath will be longer than your in-breath. The signs are now here. Don't get lost in the detail. Let your awareness go free. Imagine, oh, I'm thirsty. She's thirsty. Give her water. I'm cold. Instead of, ah, the earth element. Ah, the water element. Just recognize what an adventure this transformation is. The appreciation of death and the spiritual journey after death is the prerequisite for living life joyfully now. Death does not have to be treated as an enemy for you to delight in life. Keeping death present in your consciousness as one of the greatest mysteries and as the moment of incredible transformation imbues this moment with added richness and energy that otherwise is used up in denial. I encourage you to make peace with death, to see it as the culminating adventure of this adventure called life. It is not an error. It is not a failure. It is taking off a tight shoe, which you have worn well. But those that find the way in the morning can gladly die in the evening, it is said in the mystical literature. So I encourage you to explore and find in your being that part of you that is on those other channels, so that when on channels 1 and 2, the World Turns series comes to its final chapters, you won't be caught in feeling loss. but rather the adventure. Because from where I'm sitting, life on this plane of reality, because I live in the world of reincarnation, of karma, of life on this plane is like being in the fourth grade. You took birth here because you had certain work to do that involved the suffering you do, the kinds of situations you found yourself in. This is your curriculum. It's not an error. Where you are now with all your neuroses and your problem, you're sitting in just the right place. Imagine that. Imagine that. Nobody made an error. And all that stuff in you of saying, if only I could be. No, this is it, including the if only. It's perfect. And then at the time you graduate, and somebody says, oh, but he died so young. So if you graduate from fourth grade early, big deal. Wonderful. Don't get so caught in worshiping life that you lose the balance, that realizing that the spirit, it says, live life fully and richly as a partner with God, and at the same moment, don't be afraid of the next thing. Go towards it with openness and with love, and not with forbidding. The way that is understood in the morning, one can gladly die in the evening.